Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is George Terwilliger. George is a very well-known super lawyer from the District of Columbia and elsewhere. He handles today many politically sensitive and governmentally sensitive and publicly sensitive cases, which we're going to be talking about in just a minute. Full disclosure, George and I worked together for many years when we were both United States attorneys and when we worked together in Washington. George Terwilliger, With Respect. George, how are you today?
I'm doing well, John, and it's so good to hear your voice and connect with you.
Likewise, we haven't done this long a conversation for a long time. But George, we always start off with this for all of our guests. Where are you from originally?
I was born and raised in a small town in New Jersey called Metuchen. I had a just wonderful upbringing. It was a borough, a small 2 mile square village, really, with a main street, and everybody knew everybody else. And when I was a kid, you could safely bike anywhere and everywhere as a kid, day or night. It was a wonderful upbringing.
Well, you know, when I was raised on the south side of Chicago, we had the same experience. We're of an age where when I was, 8, 9, 10, I could take my bicycle and ride it down to the Museum of Science and Industry and, you know, park it there and spend the day in the museum and drive back or ride back, and never a problem. I'm not sure that either one of us could do that today in our respective...
Well, I'm sure that's true. And there's a difference between us, John. I was probably more likely to ride my bike down to the ice cream stand.
Yeah, I did that too, I'm afraid, George. Okay, George, you're a lawyer. And, you know, there's a million different stories about how somebody becomes a lawyer. Why? And what do they go through? So why did you get started in the law? What was the thing that drew you there?
Well, it was kind of a two-step process, John. In the first instance, my dad was a civil engineer who, when I was about 10, left a large construction company to start his own consulting, engineering, and land surveying practice. And in connection with that practice, a lot of his clients were lawyers, people, you know, getting subdivision rights from various towns and that sort of thing. So I used to deliver a lot of stuff to lawyers' offices and so forth. And then one of those lawyers, when I was probably about 14, hired me to be a runner. And I would get on the train on the old Pennsylvania Railroad and take the three-hour trip to Washington, D.C. to file materials for him with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And so I got to spend some time hanging around his office and seeing what was going on. And I also worked on one of my dad's land survey crews all through junior high school, and part of college. And I can remember thinking, particularly on some hot summer days or really cold winter days, having an inside job might be preferable. and at one point, I took a book out of the library. My mother was a librarian in the local library, so I spent a lot of time there. And I took a book out of the library called So You Want to Be a Lawyer. And I read it. I was probably 13 or 14 at the time. And I just got it into my head that I thought that was something I would like to do. I'll confess that I, you know, in a lot of things, I was dyslexic and I wasn't the best student in the world. I got some great grades in some things and some terrible grades in other things. And by the time I got to college, I thought law school was a distant dream, but it worked out after all.
What, do you have any brothers or sisters?
I do. I'm the oldest. I have a sister who is 4 years younger than I am and a brother who is 10 years younger than I am.
All right. The question is, did they become lawyers or librarians?
No, neither. My sister sells real estate around Princeton, New Jersey, has lived there all of her adult life. My brother has had a great career as a hospital administrator. He was the vice provost first at UCLA Medical School and then the University of Pittsburgh Health System, and he now lives in Boston and runs a small hospital system up there.
So now you studied to be a lawyer. Where'd you go to law school?
Went to Antioch Law School when Antioch University had a law school. And it's kind of an interesting story. I was living and working in Charlottesville, Virginia for a year and a half between college and law school, working as a land surveyor, actually. I was back in my hometown and I ran into a woman girl that was in my high school class who started telling me about her boyfriend who was going to this really neat law school in Washington, D.C., where in addition to the typical academic experience of law school, they also ran a legal clinic, so they believed in the practical and clinical part of education, legal education. So I applied there, but I really wanted to go to the University of Virginia. I got waitlisted at UVA, but Antioch accepted me, and so I decided, you know, I should go where they want me. And it made all the difference in my life because within the first 9 months I was there, I was assigned, against my wishes, I might add, to be an intern, a law clerk in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C. And as soon as I started doing that work of being a federal prosecutor or helping federal prosecutors at that point, I fell in love with it. And I worked there for the next 2 summers, as well as in the civil appellate section of the Justice Department in Washington. And it just, you know, the school I went to made all the difference.
You know, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because there are so many people that I've run across, either in hiring them or running across them in court, or we get talking, become friends. And I found that the law school that you went to sometimes defines where you end up. And mm-hmm. back in the day when I was in law school, our law school, John Marshall Law School in Chicago, had a heavy emphasis on patent law, but also on clinical work. And whereas at the same time, most of the other university law schools had purely academic a treatment of the law. And I found that contrary to what some university lawyers thought, that the clinical lawyers were some of the ones who had a clinical experience were better. They were better trial lawyers. They were better, even better researchers, I found, because they had real life experience.
I think that's very true, John. And it was certainly true with my classmates, probably, I don't know, 20 or 25% of my class were people like me who were not going directly from undergraduate to law school, but had had some other life experience. And I also would note that my law school class, which was the Antioch Law School class of 1978, was the first class at an ABA accredited law school that was more than 50% women. And I believe my whole career, that has been a huge help to me. And the clinical part was critical. I had a real live client within 6 weeks of starting law school. It was a Marine who had been dishonorably discharged. And I was trying to get his discharge upgraded in front of something called the Naval Discharge Review Board over at the Pentagon. And the cases were heard by a board of five officers, all lawyers, military officers. And when this hearing was over, and, you know, these guys are like totally poker faced. You can't read a thing. I was walking out into the hallway at the Pentagon, and one of them, a Marine captain, stopped me, and he said, "Son, what year are you in law school?" And I said, "Oh, this is my first year, and I'm sure it showed." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Not at all. If you decide to be a litigator, you're going to be a hell of a good litigator," and patted me on the shoulder. And needless to say, I walked out of there 3 feet off the ground.
Now, I got to ask the question, what happened to your client?
His discharge was upgraded.
There you go.
I made an argument that called upon my family's experience. My father and grandfather were both in the Navy in the Pacific during World War II. And I had studied the regulations really carefully. And there is, at least then, I don't know if it's still true now, John, there is a distinction to be drawn between being discharged as unfit for the Marine Corps as opposed to unsuitable. And if you are unsuitable, what that basically is a determination that you don't have the stuff to be a Marine and you never should have been admitted in the first place. And therefore, it would be unfair to discharge you dishonorably because it was their mistake, not yours. Mm. And that was the argument I made. And he was upgraded on the basis of having been unsuitable for service. Needless to say, my client was not real happy sitting there listening to me explain to these five officers why he never should have been a Marine in the first place.
You know, there's a famous story in the autobiography of a very famous political lawyer in Washington, Clark Clifford, advisor to presidents and quite a figure. And he told about how when he started the practice coming out of law school, he needed some experience, and he was with a big firm out there and in St. Louis. And but he went in for an appointment to do some appointed defense work. And the first fellow he was appointed to represent was being charged with bank robbery. And he worked and he worked and he worked and he tried the case, and the jury came back guilty as charged. And he was crushed, just crushed. So he's turned away. After this, the fellow was sentenced to a substantial sentence. And he turned away from the judge, and he started to walk away. And the judge called him back and said, "Mr. Clifford, come back here." He said, "You feel badly, don't you?" "Oh, Your Honor, I just feel, what did I do wrong?" "You didn't do anything wrong," he said. "But you need to do, what you need to do is get right back on the horse and do it again." And so he immediately turned around, and he appointed him to represent another armed robber. And Clifford just said, "Oh, you can't do this to me." But he did. He lost that case. In fact, Clifford reported that he lost his first 12 cases before he finally won one. So, but he had the gumption to go back at it. And lo and behold, he became, as we know, one of the famous and most effective political, I say in the best sense, or government lawyers in American history. So, George, you didn't stop being an assistant, being a law student, intern in the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. But we're going to go on, going to talk about what happened after that, but we're going to take a break right now, and we'll be right back. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. Our guest is George Terwilliger, who is truly a super lawyer from the right now from the Washington area and is a member of a large firm, McGuire Woods Battle and Brooks. And we're going to be talking to him more about his career and some of the tough things that are going on in our society dealing with government and law and public interest. This is John Smetanka, and we will be right back. Now back on With Respect with George Terwilliger is our guest. He is a truly super lawyer from the, originally started off in New Jersey and now is working out of the nation's capital and handling many interesting cases we're going to be talking about in a bit. This is John Smetanka. So George, you finished your term as an intern. What happened after that?
Well, I worked in the office for two summers, and then there was a policy in that office, as there were, as you know, John, in many U.S. attorneys' offices, that they did not hire students directly out of law school. Hire prosecutors directly out of law school. But I applied nonetheless because I was given to understand that at least because under the law students in court program, I had tried and won 7 misdemeanor jury trials as a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and that maybe I would have a shot at getting hired straight away. I nonetheless applied for some clerkships, and a judge did hire me as a law clerk. And then a couple months before graduation, so maybe around April, the U.S. Attorney's Office said they were, in fact, going to give me an offer to come on as a prosecutor. And so now I was in a dilemma because I had already accepted this job to be a clerk for a judge. What I really wanted to do was go on and straight away be a prosecutor. So I went to the judge and explained the situation to him, and he was kind of a gruff fellow, later became a really close personal friend. He said to me, "All right, I'll let you out of it, but you got to find me a good law clerk." So I realized that, recalled one of my classmates had a clerkship that fell through, I think because the judge had passed away or had become gravely ill. So I asked him if he was interested in this clerkship and said he was. And he went down and met the judge and so forth, and the judge hired him. As I said, that judge and I became good friends over the subsequent years, including, you know, having dinner together and things of that sort. And every time I would see him, he would tell me how that fellow was a damn sight better law clerk than I ever would have been.
Don't you love it?
So I started work in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the summer of 1978. Went through the normal rotation. That office is also the local prosecutor as well as the federal prosecutor. So everybody starts out doing street crime at the lowest level and working their way up and so forth. And I remember one of my earliest cases I was assigned a case of a woman who had shoplifted some sexy lingerie from one of the Washington department stores. And the complicating factor was that she was the spouse of a very prominent individual on the White House staff in the Carter administration. And, I never knew why they gave me the case. It didn't come to me in the normal rotation. I knew John, you'll appreciate this. She had, high-powered lawyers from K Street and all that stuff who made a lot of really kind of silly arguments to me. But I decided that she was sort of right on the edge of being eligible for a pretrial diversion program, which would mean that she would never be charged publicly. And if she successfully completed this diversion program, she would be have no criminal record. And when I understood the story, which I hope you'll appreciate, I'll keep to myself behind what had actually motivated this act to occur, I thought that, frankly, the opprobrium that would attach to her and her husband of just the disclosure of the event was a punishment far, far in excess of the wrong. So I stretched a bit and got her into a diversion program, and no one ever knew a thing about it.
You know, that's interesting because you were a prosecutor. I was a prosecutor. I was a county assistant prosecutor, then prosecuting attorney for my county. And then we'll talk about it later, but we were both U.S. attorneys about the same time. But one of the things that you learn when you first start off, when you do those, you call it low-hanging cases, or the hard, the things to break in on, but you learn about human nature. You learn about the fact that not everything is black and white. There's a lot of grays and multicolors in the rainbow of kinds of people that you come in contact with as a prosecutor or as a defense attorney. And I think that that's one of the things that kept me going in prosecution for so many years, 25, and in private practice now for an equal amount of time, is the diversity. Every day is a different day. And I mean that every day brings something new. You never know when you walk into the prosecutor's office in the morning what's going to happen, for sure. Even if you're
I'll tell you a story about that, John, that I don't think you do know, as close of friends as we have been over the years, about one of those days. I was in the office fairly early because my wife had just given birth to our second child. They were both in Columbia Hospital for Women, which is on Washington Circle in D.C., or was at the time. And there had been some complications. I guess my son was 2 or 3 days old at that point. But I had some things I had to get done before I could go over and visit at the hospital. And about mid-morning, I was on the phone with a lieutenant in the Metropolitan Police Department about a case I was working on. I was in the major crime section at this point of the district court part of the office. And the lieutenant said to me, "I'm sorry, I've got to go. There's been a shooting at the presidential party at the Hilton," and he hung up the phone. So I walked into my supervisor's office, the chief of the major crime section, and he had a television in his office, and he immediately turned it on, and the normal programming was on, and I remember it was CBS, and within 15 seconds of him turning the TV on, there was a break-in with a news bulletin that there had been a shooting at the Reagan presidential party at the Hilton up on Connecticut Avenue. And of course, you know, the whole world knows and recalls what happens from there. I spent that the rest of that day doing a number of things in response to the initial investigation, including with a colleague of mine writing the search warrant for John Hinckley's hotel room. And I worked well into the evening. The last thing I did was make sure that we charged the shooting of the Secret Service agent who was wounded at the time. And I asked the Secret Service to send over an agent who could attest to probable cause on that particular charge. And they sent over one of the members of the detail who, as you can imagine, was completely shaken up. And after we finished our business, we went down into the basement of the courthouse, and because I wanted to buy him a cup of coffee and just talk to him. And we got down there and there was nobody there. Having taken the stairs, all the cafeteria staff were gone. The place was empty. The lights were on. Everything was there. So we helped ourselves to a cup of coffee and sat down to talk. Only later did I find out that because of fears of what had happened to Oswald at the time of the Kennedy assassination, before Hinckley was brought into the courtroom for his initial arraignment, they had cleared the courthouse, except for the two of us. later that evening, it's the one and only time I ever used my credentials for a personal purpose. When I got over to go to the hospital and visit with my wife and son, Washington Circle was completely cordoned off by the Metropolitan Police and the Secret Service. And I found a Secret Service agent at one of the checkpoints, and I showed him my credentials, explained the situation, and I said, if you need to check me out, call. And I gave him the name of the agent I had been with in the cafeteria, and he said, go on through. And I was able to go visit my wife and child. But was you talk about a day you'll never forget, that was certainly one of them.
Well, you know, that is it obviously is a super event that everybody knows about it. But what you're describing is what happens day in and day out to people around the country, both in the prosecution area and in the defense area, in the criminal justice system. It happens. It's fascinating. When you start to tell this story, I can just envision all the places that you were and the people, the kinds of people you talked to. And certainly we've seen the video of the assault, the shootings of the Secret Service agent and the president, President Reagan. But taking it down a notch in terms of public attention, even the smallest day, smallest event can have human consequences that change your life, that you begin to understand human nature is not a very simple thing it's cookie cutter. We're all the same. It's all different.
Well, that's so true, John. And you know, it's one of the things, your point is well taken. You know, we look at statistics today about the incredible rise in violent crime, particularly in several urban centers around the country. And the work of these so-called progressive prosecutors who believe in restorative justice, whatever that means, where they wind up not charging people who commit serious crimes, where they do not detain pending trial people who are a danger to the community, things that that we fought for in the Reagan administration and after. To change the law. But behind each and every one of those statistics, there are victims, people who died, family members, people who were wounded. And, you know, we just, if you care about humanity, you cannot be cavalier about violent crime.
That's right. In fact, when I was when I became the prosecutor in my office, and later as U.S. attorney, I found out there was an interesting phenomenon, and that is when I would hire somebody who was very conservative, pro law and order, all black and white thinking, and then the next person came in was very liberal, and you know, the police are tough and they're tougher than they should be and so on. I found out that as soon as I put them into a case or a group of cases where they saw real victims, some of my most aggressive prosecutors were the ones that started off liberal.
And, for sure.
And they said when they saw what happened to real victims and their families after a violent crime, they became very strong advocates. Listen, we're going to take another break right now. We're talking to George Terwilliger. George is a super lawyer from Washington, D.C., and a friend for many years. We worked together in different capacities over the years. We're going to be talking more about the kinds of work he does now in a bit, but I'm also going to flesh out some thoughts about how we work together in the department. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we will be right back. Now back and with respect with our guest today, George Terwilliger, a super lawyer from Washington, D.C. today, but came from New Jersey to start with and worked his way up the hard way till he became about what we're going to tell you about. This is John Smetanka with respect. George, all right, you handled part of the day's events when Ronald Reagan was shot at the Hilton in Washington. But you went on to something beyond being an assistant United States attorney in the district. What was that, and how did that happen?
Well, my wife and I decided, despite the fact that she was born and raised in North Carolina, that we thought we would, when I had been an assistant between 3 and 4 years, and she had just graduated from law school, I was fortunate to get a job as an assistant U.S. attorney in Vermont. We loved Vermont. We loved to ski. We loved the place. I had grown up going up there to go skiing with my family and so forth. And at any rate, we moved up there in October of 1981. And lo and behold, I was, as soon as I got there, I was assigned a very, very difficult case. The man who was just coming back as U.S. attorney at the Times, a wonderful man named George Cook, was the dean of all U.S. attorneys in the country, oldest and longest serving. He assigned me this very difficult case. I won't go into the details of it. It would be boring, but it was an unpopular case, had 7 co-defendants, all local people, some very good people, but who had gotten involved in illegal firearms trafficking. And it was a very hard-fought case. I tried that case. I won it. All those defendants were convicted and all those convictions were held up on appeal. And as a result, my relationship with the U.S. attorney became very close because he was very worried that that case, which had been indicted under his predecessor, could become an embarrassment to his tenure if it was lost. A few years later, as some people had come and left the office, he asked me to be what you know, John, is the first assistant or the chief assistant in the office. And I was in that job about a year and a half, and he walked in one day in the summer of 1986 and said to me, my eyesight is going bad. I don't want to be driving up and down the state anymore. I've decided to retire on October 1st. And I grew up with my good friend Bob Stafford, the senior Republican senator from Vermont. And he and I both think you'd make a great U.S. attorney if you would like the job. And needless to say, I think I'd like to do that.
Yeah.
There was competition, as there always is, for those jobs. And the competition was stiff. One was a former state attorney general. The other was the a very well-respected lawyer who was chairman of the state Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator, this is where I first learned a little about Washington politics. I picked up the newspaper one morning, and it said, Senator so-and-so, the fellow from the state Judiciary Committee, picked to be U.S. attorney. And I went, whoa, holy smokes. So I called Senator Stafford's administrative assistant, his chief of staff, and I said, what gives here? And he said, well, the senator had to send down four names, and he did send down four names. But one of those names has a check mark next to it, and it's not that fellas. So I got the job. I remember coming down to the Justice Department on election day in 1986 to be interviewed by the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General for the job. First time I had ever been on the fourth and fifth floors of the Justice Department, where you and I wound up spending a lot of time. And, like many of us, John, who have been privileged to be presidentially appointed United States attorneys, I think it was the best job I ever had.
Well, you know, I'm going to interject something here. I was in the receiving line at a reception for the Administrative Law Conference, annual conference, and the guest was a Supreme Court justice who had just been appointed. And we went through the line, my brother, who is better known than I was in Washington, went ahead of me, and I came after that, and I shook his hand, and he said, so what do you do? And I said, well, I'm U.S. attorney, Western District of Michigan. So I started to move on. He grabbed my hand. He said, no, you know, you've got the best job in the U.S. government. And I said, well, that's very nice of you. Thank you. So I started to walk again, and he pulled me back. He said, no, I'm serious. U.S. attorney is the best job in legal America. And you know what? He was right.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
At any rate, go ahead. So you became U.S. attorney in Vermont and were a part of that community, but you also stepped up and got a call, and you became an associate deputy attorney general. How did that happen? And tell us about that.
Well, two things sort of happened there. I had been U.S. attorney a short time when three individuals tried to smuggle a bomb across the U.S.-Canadian border from Quebec into Vermont. And it turned out that they were members of a group called the Syrian Socialist Nationalist Party, or the SSNP, which had a very violent history in the Middle East of terrorist activity. And this was the first time a Middle Eastern terrorist group had ever tried to smuggle an improvised explosive device into the United States. The case got an incredible amount of national attention, as well as within the government. Every agency you know with intelligence concerns, and some that you probably don't know, wanted to know what the facts were and so forth. And I was deathly afraid that the department would take this case away from me. Fortunately, from my days in Washington, there were people I knew in the criminal division and elsewhere. And I knew the assistant attorney general for the criminal division. And I went down to Washington and I said, please keep this case with me. And I remember being asked, well, how are you going to approach it? How are you going to try it? And I said, well, it's very circumstantial, but I'm not going to say a word about terrorists through the course of the trial. As a case of unlawfully trying to smuggle an improvised explosive device into the United States, it's pretty straightforward. The terrorist stuff I'll bring up at sentencing, and that'll take a lot of potential error and sensationalism out of the trial. And I guess that got some traction with, you know, career lawyers who recommended that I do keep the case. And that led Attorney General Thornburg to invite me to be on the Attorney General's Advisory Committee, a group, as you know, John, of a few of the U.S. attorneys who come to Washington regularly and provide advice and perspective from the field to the Attorney General. And through that process, I met the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel at the time, a fellow named Bill Barr. Mm-hmm. And I happened to be in Washington for a meeting of the Attorney General's Advisory Committee when I got a message from Bill Barr's secretary that he wanted to see me. And he had just become the acting deputy attorney general. The previous deputy attorney general, the number two person in the department, had left. And Bill was taking that job. And he asked me to come up and meet with him. And so I did. And we talked for a while. And he basically said, look, I don't know anything about being a prosecutor. You're a prosecutor. A lot of what has to be addressed and decided in the deputy's office involves the prosecution function. So I was hoping maybe you'd come down and help me out for a while as a detailee while remaining U.S. attorney. As you know so well, I did that. He invited you to do the same thing along with our friend Jim Richmond. And the three of us were down there working for Bill for, I guess, close to a year, during which Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and the U.S. went on a war footing. And all of a sudden, as part of my portfolio, I was going to meetings at the White House and in the Situation Room dealing with various and sundry national security issues arising from the country being on a wartime footing. So I kind of jumped into the deep end of the pool, as you know.
Well, yes, I understand how it happened, because one Saturday morning in May, I got a telephone call from my brother, and he says, hey, why is Bill Barr trying to reach you? And I said, I don't know. So I called back and he started off, John, this is Bill Barr. And I just want to say I'm just about to become deputy attorney general. And I would like to, have you ever thought about coming down to Washington? I said, yeah, I thought about it. He said, you want to come down? I said, no, I don't. Why? Because I've had enough of that. I've seen what Washington does to people. And so anyway, we chit-chatted and finally he said, all right. I said, okay. 90 days. That's it. I'm going to do 90 days. And I got down there, and he said, well, why don't you like Washington? I said, it's too damn hot and humid. And he said, so I got into the office and got in my office. The second day I was there, the deputy head of the administrative section of the department came in with a workman and put in an air conditioner wall unit. And I said, well, why is this? And he said, well, because Barr told us that you don't like the weather, and so he has to keep you for long enough so that he wants air conditioning here. But at any rate, you and I worked for Bill and had a great time. We were with Jim called the Three Amigos. And we did a hell of a good job as helping the department function well. And I think that the experience that each of us has had as U.S. attorneys in different districts gave a stability and a good relationship between the U.S. attorneys around the country and the main justice, which is where we were at on the fourth floor. And as I'm going to shorten this up because we have lots more to talk about, but at one point I went back to Michigan and was nominated for the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and you stayed on and you became Deputy Attorney General. And great experience. You did a great job there. And all good things come to an end, and both of us went separate ways for a while. And, you know, when we come back, we're going to break now, but when we come back, you went into a different part of your career that has a tremendous impact on the world, and I think that we need to talk about that. So this is John Smetanka, everyone. With respect, we're talking to George Terwilliger, who is, as we said before, a super lawyer, and we're going to talk about what that means. He is in Washington, D.C., This is John Smetanka, and we will be right back. We're now back on With Respect with George Terwilliger, a super lawyer from Washington, D.C., who so far has told us about his career and the things he's happened that in his life that have been extremely interesting. And now we're going to talk about something, George, that is hard for people to understand, because we'll talk about how and why in a minute. But you are now a lawyer who represents political people, governmental people, business people in defense or in when they're in great stress. So this is John Smetanka. George, what happened? You're a prosecutor and all of a sudden you're out and you've now put the different hat on.
Well, that is true, but it's only different in marginal ways, because the way our system works, as you know so well, John, and but for just to remind your audience, our justice system is an adversarial one, which means that out of the adversarial process, truth and justice are designed to emerge. Sometimes it's a pretty rough process. Sometimes the justice itself can be pretty rough. But that's how it works. And when I left public service and, I think being Deputy Attorney General, which, as you know, supervising all of the nation's United States attorneys, the director of the FBI, DEA, all the justice components, it's a huge, huge job with an incredible amount of responsibility and an incredible amount of power. And then all of a sudden you're out there and, your concerns are just those of your clients. And I embraced that role in part because Having been a prosecutor and having been both in the positions that I was at Justice and seeing some of the cases from that side, I knew the awesome, awesome power of the federal government and of the Justice Department and of the prosecution function. And when people get caught up in that system, there is real danger to their well-being. And your job as a lawyer for a person or a company in that circumstance is to make sure that that they find a just result. Some people are guilty, and some people have to pay consequences. Others are not. And when they're not, and the wheels of justice threaten to grind them up, it's your job to find a way, if at all possible, to prevent that from happening. And I've enjoyed that role. I'd like to believe that that I and the teams of people I've worked with over the years accomplish what we have accomplished because we are good lawyers. And we test the system. You know, as you know, John, I've represented senators and congressmen and major corporations, international banks, and so forth. And helping those people navigate through something that is totally unfamiliar to them, that is the process of federal investigation and or prosecution.
You've represented a president. You've represented... I think you even represent cabinet officers and attorney general. And even now, I think, I know you can't talk about it much, but Mark Meadows, who is the former chief of staff for President Trump, is someone that you're representing. So we'll leave that one alone. But it's that kind of visibility. It explodes when there is a, someone like, an attorney general or a congressman or senator, when they get identified as a target of an investigation or a subject of an investigation, there is a just tremendous amount of pressure and publicity that comes out of that. And the press is not necessarily the friend of those people, and they don't always handle them with kit gloves. So how do you, as a representing those folks, how do you deal with that, the pressure?
Well, it's a great question, John. I mean, it is an awesome responsibility. And, you know, I'll probably maybe live a few months short of what I might have otherwise lived from staying up at night and worrying about it. I mean, most of those clients are also people who have become friends, and I value that greatly. They much like, you know, we entrust our physical well-being to a doctor. When somebody hires you in a circumstance such as you described there to be their lawyer, they're entrusting, particularly with a political figure, but also business people who, you know, worked hard their whole lives to become a CEO or a CFO. And now it's all threatened. They're entrusting more than just a legal outcome to you. And, you know, one of the things I've tried to do over the years, and others will have to be the judge of whether or not successfully, but I've worked very hard to try to have as good a relationship as I possibly can with people in the media and the press. Such that, you know, I can talk to them very often on background or off the record, and at least get a client a fair shake. And believe it or not, despite, you know, the whole fake news thing and all that, the vast majority of reporters want to get it right. It's pretty easy to figure out who the good ones are that operate that way. And frankly, there are some who don't care, that just want to sensationalize and exploit somebody else's troubles. And, you know, those people you'd stay away from and you don't try to help. But I think that's an important element of it, because people's very reputation, professional and personal, are very much in your hands.
That's right. And yes, the most of the reporters, vast majority of the reporters that I have dealt with, do take it seriously about getting the story right. And without violating your client's confidentiality, you can, if you play straight with a reporter, that's the key thing. If you ever lie to a reporter, you're done. You're not only done with that reporter, the word gets around. And I learned that lesson when my boss told me that that line when I first started being his chief assistant. He said, never, ever, 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 under any circumstance, lie to a reporter. And never ask for a benefit from them. Ask, you know, an editor to cut out, to spike a story. Because what they will do is turn around and, A, you've lost your credibility as a reporter, and pardon me, as a lawyer. And also, they're going to stick it to your client or to your prosecutor's office even more so, because you try to interfere with what they're legitimately trying to do. So, unfortunately, that is a world that is high visibility and high energy. You lost how many, 6 months of your life? I'd be surprised if it wasn't a year of your life, because that is a tough world that you're working in. So, George, what about the world today in government, in politics, and in business, and all the other areas of the groups that are active in our world, unions and whatnot? Is my perception that we have not seen this much division in our society since perhaps the late 1960s, when I was at the Democratic Convention in 1968, and I saw weird, horrible things going on that shook me. How about you? Do you see this now? You're in the mix of all this down there in D.C. What do you think?
Well, there is no question that there is a tremendous amount of division. I frankly lay a lot of that, at least at the national political level, John, to the phenomena of political gerrymandering of congressional districts, because it basically makes it advantageous to both sides to play to their core as opposed to a more balanced electorate. But in addition to that, there's more than that going on. And, you know, maybe I'm looking at the glass half full, but I think part of what we're experiencing now, and it's probably very difficult to see while you're in the middle of it, is really a tectonic shifting of national attitude. We've sort of gone from one extreme to another. We needed a President Trump really badly, because a political elite had basically taken over the direction of the country and weren't listening to people. I can remember when Mitt Romney was running for president, talking to some people on his campaign staff and saying, you know, he's got to get out there and connect with individuals who feel forgotten and lost and unrepresented. And, you know, who would have thought that a billionaire real estate developer from Manhattan would be the one to make that connection? But he was. Unfortunately, I think in the post 2020 election period, he forfeit many of the gains that had been made politically. But nonetheless, if you step back from sort of all of that that personality type issues, what you really see happening is a movement of the country that I think is going to result in a new majority. I don't know whether it'll be Republican or Democrat or some other paper or some political coalition, but the vast majority of people in this country who vote, the voting majority, are people who are a little left to center or a little right to center on some issues. But the thing that binds them together is common sense and a love of those things that are the most essential to our system and to our culture, the love of individual liberty, the love of opportunity. Don't give me something, give me a chance.
Right.
The love of fairness and indeed justice. That's what people want. They don't want to be manipulated. They don't want to be spoken down to. And for the most part, they don't want a handout. They want an opportunity. I grew up around hardworking people who loved having a job.
George,
and I think that's how we are.
And George, I'm terribly sorry to have to do this, but we're running out of time. It's been very interesting. And maybe I'll have you come back and we can talk more about where the country is going, where it should go, and what your role in this is going to be. So,
well,
George.
Thanks, John. It was great talking to you.
It's great. We are on With Respect, and remember, we're on every Sunday and Thursday. And until next time, remember our motto: if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.